Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I am bacheloring it, I guess, is the comment that I would make. I'm here by myself. Shelley and Elliot are up at in Idlewild at King's Camp, a youth camp that where Shelley is going to be spending the week responsible for crafts. And Elliot, this is Elliot's first experience as a camp counselor. So he has a cabin of seven kids that he is co-counseling. I think that they're going to need a lot of counseling after that, but I'm actually really excited for him. One of the neat things about and I know many of you recognize this about watching kids grow is seeing them go from their very first day at camp to watching them become veteran campers and knowing all the songs and having all the experience of that, and then seeing them come back to camp and serve at King's Camp. They call them gophers, and they're basically, they carry water around and they set things up and they do that. Elliot did that for a couple of years, and now he is going back to camp as a counselor. Paul, Sam, and Joel have all done that, and so it's just really neat to see the way that that camp and that community of young people and of the people who serve those young people have really blessed, my kids, Elliot in particular right now, and then to think of Shelley up there. You might wonder why I'm not up there, and I'm very happy to say that I've got work. Very happy. We've had a week. If I seem a little bit disheveled, it's because we had a staycation at home, which was not, I mean, I think I've now decided that going away and traveling and all of that is much more relaxing than having a staycation. We traveled a lot. We went to downtown LA and to a Dodgers game. We went to the Getty and went out to eat. We went out to eat multiple times. And when you have three kids home from college, you feel that a little bit more heavily than you're used to. And then on Thursday, we drove down to Newport Beach and took the ferry out to Catalina, and we were out there for the day, which was really neat, and Shelley had arranged for us as a family to do zip lining. So suffice it to say, I still haven't recovered from that. It's well known in my family that I have a fear of heights, and that's a long established fear, and the fact that my wife would schedule the zip lining as a family bonding, I'm trying to figure out what role I had in that bonding process, if I was more the object of laughter that they shared or what. But anyway, but we survived and I'm here. And it's good to be with you. This morning I'm continuing in our series on the Gospel of John. My understanding is that Jack will be preaching next week, and I believe Jack is preaching on and you just pretend this is right and then correct me later, Jack, on John chapter 11. And then you have a reprieve, and then I come back and I'll finish our series on the Gospel of John in looking at John chapter 12. And I hope that when I sat down, I'm the one who sort of orchestrated the series as far as the different lessons. And the goal of the series is to help us think about our place in this world in terms of our relationship with Jesus and our relationship with our neighbors, as the church has been doing some reflection. And I hope that the series will have benefited your discernment and your thought process. I come back to a key point in terms of discerning our mission here in Sierra Madre. It's a simple point of who are we? What makes us a distinctive community? What have we to offer? This is an age where people spend much time trying to figure out how to market, how to reach out, how to how to sell, how to brand their products in such a way that people will want to purchase them, and indeed will feel the need that I have to have that product, I have to have that thing. Are we involved in such an effort if we ask what our relationship is with our neighbors? Are we involved in such an effort if we ask who we are, what our mission is? I think the process of discernment is deeper than that. It's not simply about what we can offer or how we can attract people. It's about who we are. It's about what is the nature of our relationship with each other, with our neighbors, with the world, and in particular with God. This passage before us in John chapter 10 is a passage of great familiarity for many people because it boils down to a simple phrase, Jesus saying, "I am the good shepherd." And I want to unpack this familiar passage. I want to get at the heart, I think, or at least at some threads of the heart of what John is trying to communicate here. To do that, first, let's set up a context. I want to reread John 10, 1 through 5. "Very truly I tell you," and here I'm going to add the Pharisees, because that's whom Jesus is speaking to in particular, and I'll tell you why I think that's the case. "Very truly I tell you, Pharisees, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the sheep for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he has brought out all his own sheep by name, he goes out ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. But they will not follow a stranger. In fact, they'll run away from him because they do not recognize a stranger's voice." To appreciate what's going on here, we need some context. We need some background. The first thing to note is that this is not a new section within the Gospel of John, since we're moving along in the Gospel of John. And even if I were just preaching on this passage out of the blue, I'd still want to spend some time pointing back to chapter 9. Because this chapter, this discussion of Jesus as the Good Shepherd, is rooted in what was going on back in chapter 9. In the story that Doug, I think it was Doug last week, who talked about the man born blind. And if you recall in that chapter, Jesus and his disciples come across a man who had been born blind, and they're trying, the disciples are trying to figure out how this could happen. Jesus takes the opportunity to demonstrate God's glory by healing the man, but then a whole series of things happen in that process. Indeed, if you lay John chapter 5 and John chapter 9 alongside each other, you'll discover that this is a recurring motif in John's gospel. Jesus does a miracle on the Sabbath, and because Sabbath is a time for not working, the Pharisees or the religious authorities come after Jesus and are distressed that he is working on the Sabbath. In John 5, the work that he does is to heal the man who is lame and can't get down to the pool of Siloam. In John 9, he heals the man who is blind. There's a lot going on in the parallels. One of the interesting things about those two chapters is that in John 5, the lame man who is healed, it's not clear that he actually aligns himself with Jesus afterwards. But it is very clear in John 9 that the man born blind, who is healed, owns his healing. When the religious authorities question him, he doesn't just simply tell them it was Jesus who healed him. He owns the fact that Jesus had healed him. And as a result, because he doesn't deflect away because he knows the Pharisees are upset with Jesus for healing him on the Sabbath, because he doesn't say, "Well, that's what Jesus did. I'm just a victim of the healing." He doesn't say anything like that. What he does is he holds true to the fact that he was healed, and as a result, the Pharisees kick him out of the synagogue. He is removed from the fold. because he will not yield to their way of seeing things. That's an important part of what sets up chapter 10, because the religious authorities, the Pharisees, who are supposed to be responsible for the well-being, the spiritual well-being of their community, supposed to be leaders within that community, examples within that community, are now concerned about protecting their understanding of what that community is to the point of throwing somebody out because he doesn't see things the way that they want him to see them. At the end of John 9, Jesus encounters the man. He hears, verse 35, that they had thrown him out. And when he found him, he said to the man, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, You have now seen him. Do you see the play on the fact that he's blind? He was blind, but Jesus has healed him. And he says, "You have now seen him. In fact, he's the one speaking with you." The man said, "Lord, I believed," and prostrated himself before him. He worshiped him. Jesus says, "For judgment I have come into this world so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, "What, are we blind too?" And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you'd not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." There is in this passage a judgment. The judgment that Jesus brings is the judgment that comes from the fact that he causes some to see. That's a deliverance, a judgment of deliverance. But in so doing, he causes others to become blind because they refuse to accept him. So part of what's going on here, in fact, part of what's going on in the whole of the Gospel of John, probably when the apostle wrote the gospel, is that believers were being cast out of the synagogue because they believed in Jesus. Most scholars believe that if you want to know the setting for the Gospel of John, it's chapter 9 that helps us to understand what was happening in the life of the community for whom John wrote the gospel. That because they believed in Jesus, the authorities who controlled the synagogue were kicking these believers out of the community. And they found themselves separated from the faith community, found themselves alone and isolated, and having to figure out how to remain faithful to God without the synagogue, without that community that had nurtured them and their families for centuries. What do they do? How could this have happened? So that's part of the background. Another part of the background is the fact that Jesus is drawing off of very familiar imagery when he starts to talk about sheep and shepherds. And there's two ways that this is familiar. First of all, this is just a part of life. He starts to talk about shepherding, and he's using imagery that for us are, you know, for most of us, I think, is opaque. I don't know how many of you are sheep farmers, but you know, for me, I'm not, and I haven't really grown up around sheep. There was a time when Shelley grew up on a farm, and I remember one of the times we were driving to her family's home near where her childhood farm was, and we're driving out near Modesto out in the countryside, and there was the lovely waft of manure. And Shelley was able to identify the different types of manure by the smell. She's not here, so I'm just having fun. And was pointing out that, you know, that one could do that if they were familiar with these things. I'm happy to say that I was unfamiliar with that. Part of the issue for us is that when Jesus tells this or uses this imagery, this figure of speech, some even say a parable of the sheep, it's lost on us. But shepherding was as regular a work in the rural setting of the Jewish people in the first century is retail workers are. I think we all know people who work in some kind of retail where they're selling, they're at the cash register, or they're straightening items, or they're doing those types of things, or if you prefer another profession, school teaching. These are ubiquitous. These are common trades that people are in, vocations that people are in. That's what shepherding was in the first century. And so Jesus is using imagery that people would have been familiar with. And you see this in the first part. He's actually talking about shepherding within the neighborhood. Chapter 10, 1 through 5 is about how you shepherd sheep, or uses imagery from shepherding sheep there in the city. So think of a city like Nazareth, or a city like Bethlehem, maybe, because we know there were shepherds near Bethlehem, so we'll use Bethlehem as an example. What happens is that during the winter, and the times when there are not a lot of rain, there's not a lot of rain, but they can keep the sheep near home. They have them actually stay on their properties in their courtyards or their houses, and maybe even if the weather is really cold, inside their houses. And they keep the sheep in by means of a door, and so you'd have a neighborhood of houses, and each of those houses would have somewhere between 5 and 10 sheep that they would have that they'd be responsible for. And then they would have somebody who would be the local shepherd, that everybody would know that that person was responsible for taking the sheep out and for caring for the sheep and then bringing them back to the homes. So that's when Jesus talks about how the gatekeeper will open up the door to the shepherd and allow the shepherd to come in and gather the sheep and take the sheep out, and that the sheep know the shepherd. This is the local neighborhood shepherd whom all the sheep know, all the families know, everybody is familiar with him. And so he's using this imagery of this familiarity about shepherding, and also the imagery of how familiar the shepherds were to everybody, and in particular to the sheep, to tell his story. We'll talk a little bit more about the varying ways that shepherds shepherd in a second, but there's a third context that I want to look at. So I looked at chapter 9 and the story of the healing of the blind man and the Pharisees kicking the blind man out of the church, throwing him out of the synagogue. I've talked about just the social context, but there's also a biblical context for the idea of shepherd. This should not be surprising that the idea of a shepherd is a big deal in terms of the Bible, because if for no other reason, the Lord is my shepherd, I'll not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. Psalm 23, right? We're very familiar with that. The ancient Jewish people and the ancient Israelites before them were very familiar with this imagery as well. And the shepherding imagery is an imagery that God used to describe the relationship between the leaders of the people and the people, the shepherds of the people, and how they were supposed to do their job and how they didn't do their job. Let's look real quick at Ezekiel chapter 34. This is one of a few places. Jeremiah is another. I've already mentioned Psalm 23, where we see the shepherding image at play. I want to read just a couple of short passages from chapter 34, beginning in 34 at the very start. The word of the Lord came to me, Ezekiel 34. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you shepherds of Israel who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. Here, Ezekiel is presenting an oracle to the leaders of the people of Israel and saying, look, you should be taking care of the people, but you're not. You're in it for yourself. What you can get out of it. As a result, God's judgment will come. And what will God do? Look with me down to verse 11 of chapter 34. For this is what the sovereign Lord says. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so I will look after my sheep. I will rescue them from all the places where they were scattered on the days of clouds and darkness. I will bring them out from the nations and gather them from the countries, and I will bring them into their own land. I will pasture them on mountains and on the mountains of Israel, in the ravines and in all the settlements of the land. I will tend them in a good pasture, and the mountain heights of Israel will be their grazing land. They will lie down in good grazing land, and they will feed in rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the Lord. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. Because the shepherds of Israel were derelict in their responsibilities, God is not going to leave it to somebody else, but God himself will be their shepherd. And he will come and he will gather the scattered sheep into his fold, and he will lead them to pastures green and care for them. So it was that the hope of the Jewish people and the hope of was that God would answer and would do and would fulfill this oracle, this prophecy, in caring for his people. It was an expectation, an anticipation. As John writes this gospel, or as Jesus comes into the midst of these people, we know what they're hoping for. They're hoping for deliverance. So here's the context then for this discussion of Jesus as the Good Shepherd, for this imagery of a shepherd with his sheep. And Jesus plays with it over 18 verses or so. He plays with it and looks at it from several different angles. And what I want you to see is just three things that we could divine, or that I'm discerning in this, that are important to who we are as God's people. One thing is the notion of the notion that the sheep know the shepherd. They know his voice, they recognize it, and they follow him. There is a relationship between the sheep and the shepherd that is unlike any other relationship, a deep familiarity. Jesus says, he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And he says, his sheep follow him because they know his voice. There's a beautiful story in John chapter 20 of Jesus as he's been resurrected from raised from the dead. And Mary Magdalene finds Jesus, but she doesn't recognize him. Do you remember that story where she confuses him for the gardener? And she's distressed because the body of Jesus is gone. And she asked the gardener, where have you taken my Lord? I will go and take him. Right? And he says to her, Mary. And the moment he says, Mary, she recognizes his voice. There is a deep familiarity between Jesus and his people. That's what Jesus is talking about here. I'll come back to this familiarity, this relationship. But I also want to talk about another thread I discern in this, is the thread of what motivates Jesus. What is his aim? What is his intention as the one who cares for the sheep? Look at verse 7. Therefore, Jesus said again, very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. What a strange imagery. When you think about it, right, it's you don't want to take it too literal, do you? I mean, sort of picturing Jesus as a door or a gate. But here, again, it'll help us to understand what he's done. He's changed the setting for the sheep and the shepherd. We're now no longer in the city, or in the little town with the houses and their wooden or stone gates that open and close. We're now up on the hillside, far away from the little town, when the sheep are out wandering the pastures and up in the mountains. And the shepherd will gather them into a fold surrounded by stones that he's erected to protect them. So the sheep come in for the night. And what does the shepherd do? The shepherd lays himself down as a door, as a barrier between the outside and the inside. All around are stones and other things to try and keep animals, predators out. But this gate, this doorway, is where the sheep can go in and out, but the shepherd lays himself down and becomes the door by which the sheep can have safety, can exit out to pasture, and can come in to be protected and to sleep. And so Jesus says, "I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture." I love this line because Jesus' intention for caring for his sheep is not simply that the sheep will be slaughtered, that the sheep will be controlled. This is not, the shepherd is not about controlling the sheep, but about guiding and leading them and allowing them to come and to go and to have life. And that's why he says, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that the sheep may have life and have it to the full." Jesus contrasts himself with the thief and the robber who comes to kill and destroy, comes for their own profit. Like the false shepherds of Israel who shepherded only for their own purposes, these thieves come to use the sheep and to take them away and to gain a profit from them. But Jesus' intention is that the sheep might live and have life to the full. His motivation is not to consume the sheep, not to use them for his own purposes. His motivation is to give life to the sheep. And the life that Jesus talks about is everlasting life. It's the life in John. It is the life that is anticipated in heaven. But in John's gospel, and really throughout the New Testament, the heavenly life that we look forward to, that we anticipate, is not just off there. It's the life that God gives us in the Spirit. It's life now. Jesus' intention is not simply to save us forever, or to save us so that keep us safe so that we can live in heaven with him. It is so that we can have heavenly life right now. His motivation is to give us life. Verse 11, "I am the good shepherd. The shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. And the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. And the man runs away because he's a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep." Here, Jesus now begins to talk about his relationship with the sheep and what compels him and what he does that separates himself from others. There are those whose commitment to the sheep is only so much, right? It's only for a paycheck. It's only for a momentary benefit or what they can get out of it. But Jesus' relationship with the sheep is such that he is committed to them and will sacrifice himself, put himself in harm's way. When the wolf comes, Jesus will not flee. He will not run. He is not the hired hand. He is the shepherd. "I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep." I want to come back to this notion of familiarity and relationship, because in verse 14, we see something in our relationship with Jesus, a window into eternity that changes the way that we should appreciate who we are as God's people. "My sheep know me, and I know my sheep, just as my Father knows me, and I know my Father." What is Jesus talking about here? He's talking about his relationship with the Father, his everlasting relationship. I know that we're trained to be skeptical of language like the term Trinity and concepts that have been developed in non-biblical traditions or in parabiblical traditions, and so we don't know what to do with this. But what I want to suggest to you is that there is something in this. There is a mystery here about who Jesus is, that he is not just simply human. He is also divine. He's not just simply in relationship with us. He is grounded in and comes from the Father. And so here he tells us that his Father and he have a kind of intimate relationship. They're interconnected. And he says that we, you and I, are interconnected with Jesus the way that he is interconnected with the Father. That's what it means to be in relationship with Jesus. It means to be swept up into the very life and love of God. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep and my sheep know me, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock of them and one shepherd. There's much that we can say about this strange little passage about other sheep. Jesus will talk about the Gentiles coming to him in John chapter 12. One thing that's really clear, though, is that we're not the arbitrators of who the sheep are. Our responsibility is not to walk along and saying, "Are you one of God's sheep? Are you one of God's sheep?" The point is that we need to trust each other, that we know Jesus' voice. We need to allow people to come to Jesus. And we need not to be surprised by who might come to him. He has other sheep. We're not the shepherds. We're not in control of who gets in and who gets out. He knows them and they know him. And we need to trust Jesus that this is so. Verse 17, the reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. There's this curious thread going through here of how Jesus lays down his life for his sheep, and that is the basis for the knowledge of his sheep and him, the relationship between him and his sheep. It's interesting, too, that the basis for the love between him and God is his laying down his life for us. Jesus' death on the cross, that's what he's talking about, his giving of himself, is not an accident to who he is as God's son. Is not something that is separate and apart from or somehow just put upon him. It is a core part of what it means that he is God's son, that he would give himself for us. And while in the story it is people who come and kill him, he makes it clear, doesn't he, that he is the one who gives his life. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. I received this command from the Father. Jesus is responsible for himself. So he comes and he gives himself for the sheep to protect them, to care for them, so that they might have life and have it to the full. And he does it freely with the intention of laying down his life and then taking it up again. No one forces him to do it. He does it out of love. Brothers and sisters, as we consider Jesus our shepherd, Jesus our gate, Jesus our Lord, as we consider him, consider yourselves. You have a relationship with God that is unlike any other imaginable relationship that you might have. Do you know God's voice? Do you hear his voice? I think you do, But maybe you're like me, and sometimes his voice seems distant. Sometimes I seem to have stopped listening to his voice. Sometimes I spend a lot of time thinking about God rather than talking to God or giving myself over to God. The fundamental relationship that we have with God requires not just simply that we think about God, or we talk of God to one another, or we do the things of God, but that we listen to him, that we follow him, that we give ourselves to him, and allow him to give himself to us. You have a relationship with God, and that relationship gives you life, everlasting life, heavenly life, not just for the day to come, but for today, right now. And it comes to you through the love of Jesus, who freely gives himself up for you. You are God's sheep. You have a relationship with God. You have life from God. And you have God's love in our shepherd, Jesus. Consider this as we stand and sing.